Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to ScaryCast, brought to you between Myrtle Beach, Hollywood, and Emerald Isle, North Carolina, and the mid part of the Carolinas. We've got tonight a very, very special guest. We will introduce that gentleman in just a few minutes. I want to go around and say greetings to my fellow co-hosts and see how they're doing. First of all, Devin Tate, how's everything out there in Hollywood tonight?
You know, it's a beautiful night here. Everybody's leaving for the holidays, so it's getting nice and quiet here. But I am actually leaving tomorrow night, flying back to Kansas City, Kansas. So I will not be here to witness the desolate, empty, quiet Los Angeles.
Well, that's all right. You can go out there and see Dorothy and Toto and your family. That's great.
Yep.
Absolutely. Well, we're glad to have you here with us tonight. Papa Stroh, the maestro of wrestling. How are you doing? You're probably doing about the same way you were on your show this evening, a couple hours earlier.
Oh yeah. Matter of fact, speaking of Dorothy, Dorothy's right here, man. She's a night owl. Yeah, this is time of the night she likes to play, so, you know, kids with all energy.
yes, I see that. Now, I tell you what, if we get you in Wilmington at Independence Mall this weekend, I know Santa's going to love Dorothy. Last time you brought Brooks, I'll tell you this, Dorothy is a good friend of Papa Stroh's. She's about 2.5 feet tall, and if you've never met her, she'll scare the heck out of you. She makes Annabelle from The Conjuring look pleasant. So, the last Santa Claus.
Yeah, the kids love giving her candy. She's such a sweet tooth.
That's exactly right. But Santa Claus did not want her sitting on his lap. But anyway, it's, we're glad to have you.
Yeah. Well, a certain Santa Claus, if you want to call him Santa Claus.
Exactly. Yeah, we got to be careful.
He looked like Dan Aykroyd from Trading Places more than likely. Yes.
Announcement. Anyway, it's always good having you here as we move into Christmas time and everything. Tonight we have a very, very special guest. Ever since I was 12 years old, or as I tell Papa Stroh, that was in 1900. Ever since I've been 12 years old, I read a book about the hollow earth. And I found that to be the most exciting thing I'd ever heard of. And, you know, then got out in the real world, got a job, didn't have a lot of time to think about it or whatever. And about 2 years ago, I ran across a book by Ingo Swann, great remote viewer who worked with Joe McMonagle on the Stargate project. In fact, thank you, Joe McMonagle, wherever you are up there in Charlottesville, Virginia, working at the Monroe Institute. Thank you for putting me on to the work of Ingo Swann. And Ingo's got a book called Penetration, and it's about work that he's done with the CIA and the FBI doing remote viewing, which, for those of you who don't remember or haven't heard me go on and on about it, it's when you get a psychic to basically look across enemy lines. They got Ingo Swann to look on the moon. And as we know, the moon, we may have more than one satellite by this point, but the moon is the strangest possible satellite in that we know of. It's perfectly round, has perfectly spherical orbit, and is likely hollow. There have been enough instances where they crashed a satellite into the moon and it rang like a bell for about a day and a half. Ingo Swann claims it is absolutely hollow and it's a base for alien intelligence. But I think it's very natural that it could be, especially with the stats on the moon and how it just doesn't act like a normal satellite for any planet, or at least certainly not any planet in our solar system. So when I saw the information again on the hollow moon, and I talked about that with the folks that I have paranormal discussions with, all of a sudden I remembered that I had read a little book about the hollow earth, and I said, golly, I need to start finding some information out about that, because it is so cool. It's such a great idea. And I think there's a lot of science that supports we may have a hollow planet here. I can tell you, I've done enough research now. NC State did a good job of training me. There is only one person that knows if the earth is hollow or if filled, and that person is named No One. That's the only person that knows, and that's No One. Don't joke there, but it's the truth. It's hard to prove anything. So one day I was on Facebook and I thought it's in the hollow earth. I came across a couple of groups, and I think two of those groups were administered by a fella named Brooke Agnew. So then, just like I did you, I sent him a Facebook message, and we started talking. About the hollow earth theory and activity in around community that believes in the hollow earth. And some weekend of mind theory tech. And we're lucky enough to have him tonight, and I'm just really, really excited about it. Brooke, good evening. Thank you for joining us tonight on Scary Cat.
Wow, this is a real privilege. I've never been on your program before, so thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Well, you're welcome. And you are also, you host a very popular podcast, don't you?
Yes, I do. It's a live broadcast on Sunday nights from 8 to 11 Eastern. It's called X Squared Radio.
Well, that's great. Well, what we're going to have to do is we need to put a link to your show on ScaryCast so that our fans can enjoy your show as well. I think that would be great. We'll talk about that next week when I get a little bit of time, after Christmas, when I get some time to do some site maintenance. We'd love to share your stories with our listeners. But anyway, first of all, you are from the Carolinas, and that's what I found so wonderful. That I've got someone right around here that is really all about the Hollow Earth and has a great degree of expertise and knowledge about the subject. Now, I guess my first question, and I always ask this to everybody, how did you get started? What first triggered you to start looking at the Hollow Earth, and how did it, exploded you, I believe, into those several wonderful groups on Facebook, and then also, you know, with your podcast. How did all that start? How did you get interested in it, Brooke?
Well, I had a co-author named E.J. Clark approached me in 2001 to write a book about the origin and destiny of the Earth. And someone that I know had to be a book about the Hollow Earth. I think it was called Our Hollow Earth. And I read it. I found it, you know, mildly amusing, and I put it on the shelf, and I didn't give it another thought for a couple of years. It took us about 3 years to write the first book. It was really large, and we had a very, very big bibliography in it. We traveled a lot, took pictures, and did our own writing and our own diagrams. And we published the book, and I guess to our amazement, it went to number 38 on Barnes & Noble. So I guess more people than I thought were interested in the subject. In the meantime, more pieces of evidence around 2004, 2005 started to fall into place, and it didn't just cause me to look up and say, you know, what about this hypothesis that planets might form as hollow spheres? It was JPL, because what happened was we had a deep space satellite that took some imagery of Earth, and in that imagery there were auroras over both poles of Earth at the same time. Well, that wasn't the way we thought of it. We always thought the auroras were caused by the solar wind, which could only strike one side of the planet at a time. It was odd to see auroras of both poles. So it got JPL excited. I did a co-op at JPL when I was in high school, so I'm kind of close to those guys still. They whipped together a satellite that has five units to it in a nose cone. They launched it, I think it was 2006. It was called the Themis probe, and it was designed to be a five-part satellite that orbited at five different altitudes. And what would happen is these satellites would occasionally line up like Jacob's ladder going out into space, and they started taking measurements specifically to determine the origin of the auroras. Well, one of these alignments, there happened to be what they called in their article a cosmic bullet. It was like an interdimensional explosion that occurred between satellites 3 and 4. Well, the explosion went out in, 360 degrees all directions. It passed satellites 4 and 5, went on out in space. It passed satellites 3, 2, and 1, and when it struck the atmosphere, the aurora appeared. So they said, that's it. The auroras are caused by cosmic bullets. And that was the end of the experiment. Well, I didn't think that held much water. So started looking at other pieces of evidence. And one of the things when you're doing a hypothesis that you want to do is you want to do as much experimentation as you can to get as much data as you can. And oftentimes that means you have to cross scientific disciplines, which is exactly what I did. I gathered information from the USGS, which is the United States Geological Survey. They measure earthquakes. That's basically what they do. And they have listening stations all over the world, and they are networked together. And when there's a large earthquake on one side of the planet, those vibrations go through the planet, and they're picked up by all the listening stations. And they each, record their vibrations. We call these seismograms. And that's about the end of it. But it's good raw data. Well, it turns out that in 2007, Dr. Y Sessions with Washington University up in St. Louis commissioned his grad students to go through 600,000 of those seismograms to try to create a model of the Earth using those vibrations as kind of a CAT scan of the Earth. And what he published was quite remarkable. What they discovered was another ocean the size of the Atlantic Ocean underneath the crust. They could pick up the waves of an ocean inside the Earth crashing against the shore on the inside of the planet. Well, that really got everybody excited. It got Stanford, it got Harvard. Elizabeth Williams, who's a professor of plate tectonics, it got Harvard, it got MIT, it got Cambridge University. They all got grant money, and they all started producing data in different disciplines. And, of course, I was collecting it and correlating it and saying, hey, this hypothesis that planets form as hollow spheres, specifically Earth as a hollow planet, is starting to look at least like we cannot rule it out. We call that a null hypothesis. We actually set about to prove that Earth is, in fact, a molten ball floating in space, and we couldn't do it. With the data that we had, we could not prove that Earth is made the way planetary core geologists have said it's been made for the last 100 years. So that's what got me excited about it. I said, if that's true, there has to be at the poles a thinning of the crust. There has to be a way for this electrojet to get out of the planet, form these auroras, and for these two oceans to mix. There has to be a thinning of the crust. So we set about seeing if there was an expedition to the Arctic to check and see if there was an opening in the crust. It turns out there was one, so I joined it in the summer of 2006. Actually, it was in the spring of 2006. And I met with the expedition leader, who at that time was named Stephen Curry. And by November, he was dead. He died of the same thing John McCain died of, brain cancer. So that was the end of that, until the board called me and said...
Real quick, with whom was he affiliated? Was it with a university or a private company?
No, he was just an expedition leader, and he had pulled together several enthusiasts. They were collecting money, and because it cost at that time, it was about $1.7 million to charter the ship to be able to go up there. Now the cost is around $3.1 million.
Okay. All right, so he passed away of brain cancer. Sorry to hear
right.
that.
Right, so then they called me and asked me if I wanted to leave the expedition. I said, well, let me think about it. So I thought about it for a month, and then I said, okay, I'll do it. So the earliest that we could try it was the summer of 2008. And the economy had something else in mind that summer.
Right.
So there wasn't any collecting a couple million dollars to go on an expedition. And we've been trying every winter since then to raise the money to pay for this expedition. We're getting closer now, though.
Okay. Well, now,
that's how it became.
Yeah, so you're doing this because you want to go up there and see if there's a hole at the top of the earth, basically. That's what you want to look for, right?
Well, what we said was, in the hypothesis, if there is a hole in the crust and these two oceans are actually blending at this point, then there has to be two or three phenomenon with this. The first one would be that the water chemistry would be very different near this opening, because we assumed that the ocean on the inside of the planet would have different salinity, different crystallinity, different microbes, different fish, and the concentration of that would show up near the vent, near the opening. And the second is that if that was true, then we should be seeing that sea life in our ocean. Well, as it turned out, in 2008, the summer, there was a very warm summer in the Arctic. It was just a strange layout of the jet stream, and the wind was blowing just right for just long enough, and the Arctic ice, what we call the red ice, this is the ice that hangs around through the summer, it broke off a big piece about half the size of a state, and it made the Northwest Passage navigable for the first time in, I don't know, maybe 20,000 years. And that summer in 2008, the NOAA commissions through its oceanographic division an expedition to Malaysia every 5 years to sample rays, you know, like manta rays and stingrays, because this particular life form is very sensitive to environmental stress, just like frogs are in the rainforest. If there's a pollution or a temperature change or an acid rain or something, then the frogs will mutate and show up different species. So normally, every 5 years, they find about 25 or 30 new species of rays. This is the normal mutation rate. But in the summer of 2008, they logged 1,500 new species. And many of these were not mutations. They were whole new things that we'd never seen before. Some of them were 6 feet across. We found dorsal squids. We found frilled sharks, which is a blind shark that we haven't seen. Well, we've seen fossils of them a million years old. We've never seen a live one. We started netting these frilled sharks in fishermen's nets off the coast of Japan. So what we were seeing was, what we believed was, an increase in, let's just call it, alien life in our ocean from another place, which the only other place that we could think of was this inner ocean. And there was one other life form that was discovered in 1831 by my ancestor, actually, Sir James Ross. He called it the Ross Gull. And the Ross Gull is just a little tiny half-sized seagull named after him, the Ross Gull. But the odd thing about this gull is that it flies north for the winter, not south. And it's not built for that kind of weather. It can't take 80 below zero. It goes north to nest in the wintertime. That means it has to find someplace warm as a species to nest. And I spoke to the world's leading ornithologist in Scotland, myself, and he said they've been following this bird for way over 100 years, and they still do not know where this bird goes to nest in the wintertime. So these are all things that, you know, lend evidence to the hypothesis. And, you know, if we get enough evidence, sooner or later a hypothesis is going to become a theory. I don't think it's there yet, but we're getting really close.
All right. Well, that's some pretty fancy footwork. I mean, as a guy that's done my time at NC State, that's very compelling evidence. And, you know, not only do you have, I guess that is current scientific evidence. I mean, I'm standing here of the rain, of course, but I've got several books here that have been interesting. And most of them talk about stories of fishermen and captains and Admiral Richard E. Byrd, who have all reported major findings of land beyond the poles. I mean, what's all that about? I mean, Admiral Richard Byrd was a pretty serious guy.
Yeah, he was definitely an explorer at a time when world records were the call of the day. So I'll tell you how that story goes. In 1926, Admiral Byrd wanted to set a record of flying nonstop round trip to the North Pole, right over the North Pole. Well, the only way to do this, he figured, was to have a modified Fokker airplane. It had three engines on it. And there wasn't any place, an airport, you know, to land this airplane. So what he did is he leased a ship called the Chantilly. The Chantilly is a little bit like the boat that went to, you know, see King Kong in the movie. Not a really big boat, and it certainly wasn't large enough to put an airplane on it. But what he did is they took the airplane apart and they put the airplane on the boat in pieces. And then they sailed to Spitsbergen, and on the coast, it's kind of a gravelly beach. They arrive at Spitsbergen, and they just happen to arrive at high tide. And they just happen to arrive literally a few hours before icebergs start coming into that bay. So they didn't have a pier. There was no pier to put the Chantilly up. So they anchored it as close as they could get it to the beach. They built a makeshift floating pier, which they had to put together pretty quickly because things were deteriorating very rapidly. And they managed to get this airplane off the boat in pieces, carry it ashore, and then they rebuilt that plane on shore and fueled it up. And, of course, it had already started snowing, so it was already getting bad. They took that plane off from the beach in Spitsbergen and flew 2,500 miles nonstop in whiteout conditions at 2,500 feet off the ground, I mean, or lower. And according to the record, of course, Admiral Byrd was considered an absolute expert at using a sextant. Well, a sextant's hard enough to use on a boat, let alone in the cockpit of an airplane. But somehow he plotted his course over the North Pole and back to Spitsbergen using a sextant. Now, he arrived a little bit early, which called into question whether he actually flew over the North Pole or not. In fact, it was redone again, I think, the next year by a competitor, and it took him longer, and he said he actually did fly over the North Pole, so it's kind of a controversy there. But the other source of controversy was that Admiral Byrd said that during his flight, he flew over areas that had lush green foliage and open space water, which there should not have been, not that time of year, and certainly not up there. And that was the most remarkable thing about his about his flight. So
wow.
Those are all the facts that I know. Everything else I've read or heard about Admiral Byrd's flight, I have managed to not debunk, but determine is what I call personal testimony. I don't have any data to back it up. So I can't say that it's false because, you know, a fact is a direct observation. But as a scientist, I like to have corroborated direct observation. And I just don't have that in those other aspects of this flight.
There's two other things. The second thing is he was down in the South Pole in the Antarctic, and he, if I'm correct, he's flying over what he determined to be the South Pole, and he saw the same thing. Lux green areas, correct?
I can't corroborate that. He flew over the South Pole in 1929, and then he allegedly did it again in 1947 during Operation High Jump. But I cannot corroborate that he saw any lush green foliage on either one of those trips.
Right. Well, he lost a number of soldiers when he had, what, just a lot of boats and a lot of planes and came back with fewer than he started with, correct?
So the story goes. You know, there's no official
yep.
record of Operation High Jump, but there's an awful lot of evidence from lots of different sources.
I mean, it's starting to sound like the Philadelphia experiment. We've got a lot of stories. A lot of stories they just keep abounding with the poles, but we don't seem to be able to get up there. I mean, I know when I look at the North Pole on Google Earth, it's fair brushed out. I mean, I can't see anything. I don't know if anybody else has tried that or not, but I mean, it's airbrushed out.
Yeah.
And,
well, in 2006, the NOAA and EUMETSAT, which is the European counterpart of them, they passed a set of laws, which they call the Data Denial Act. And that Data Denial Act says that there will be not made public any visual data above the 60th parallel, either north or south, during times of conflict or war. And as far as I know, there are no images available anywhere, not on the internet or anywhere, above the 60th parallel. Everything Google Maps has above the 60th parallel is animated.
Or as I would call it, airbrushed out. Yep. I mean, I think that's interesting. So it's the Data Denial Act. I wanted to see if you knew what that was. I had not been able to find that as I was doing some research. But I mean, you know, I've got a copy of the Antarctic Treaty.
It's real. It's real.
Is that, the data? Well, that's fine. Thank you for letting us know. I mean, so where do we go from here? Here's my last question. In the preface to the missing diary of Admiral Richard E. Byrd, who's the fellow behind that? His name is Timothy Green Buckley. Do you know him?
No, I spoke to Mr. Bielek about the diary. He claims that he held it in his hand. He recited some pieces of it, you know, to me, and he claimed that it was real. And I'm not, you know, gonna refute, you know, Al. I think the world of him, but I haven't been able to corroborate that diary was actually real.
Okay. For those of you listening, it's kind of a short book. It's about 35 pages as I have printed it out, and it talks about Admiral Byrd having his plane crack beamed down into the cavernous Hollow Earth, and he had a meeting with someone from Hollow Earth saying, "Be careful up there because you are playing with fire with your nuclear weapons." and so they take Admiral Byrd back. That's the sum total of that. And it's made its rounds, and it's on Scribd. I mean, I remember Scribd, and I can find some pretty interesting things out there. I just wonder if the Men in Black are watching.
I just missed it out of hand, but I did read a philological analysis of that diary. And philology is the study of writing styles. And the philologist determined that the diary and most of the really published writings of Admiral Byrd are two different people.
Okay. Well, I guess the reason I wanted to bring that up is in the preface, they talk about, we're going to take a flight from Reykjavik, Iceland, directly north, just like Admiral Byrd did, and we're gonna go see what's up there. Now, are we going to be able to do that? Is there something that would prohibit us from going straight north to 90 North?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, because that area that we want to go see is not actually the North Pole. It's a little bit off of the North Pole, about 86 degrees north. It actually belongs to the Russians. It doesn't belong to America. And the shipping company that we're using is the Russian shipping company, the Murmansk shipping company. It's their boat, the Arctica. And they're not restricting us at all.
So that's the issue, is that this opening seems to be in the Russian waters, correct?
Right, right.
Gotcha. All right, well, that makes now I understand why they'd want to take off from Reykjavik, Iceland, and not take off from New York City, because that would mean it's an American flight going into Russian waters. But something from Iceland going into Russian waters might be all right. That makes sense.
Well, we checked into chartering a plane to do it, but an airplane, the lowest that they would agree to fly is 17,000 feet. And we just figured we wouldn't see anything from 17,000 feet. We wanted to see it from sea level. So that's why we're trying to do it by ship.
Okay.
Plus, we're not going to take pictures out of a side window. We're going to take water samples. We're going to drop what we call a gravity missile off the side of the boat. These are a kind of a neat drone. You drop them over the side of the boat. They fall by their own weight to the bottom. They slam into the bottom and take a core sample. A few seconds later, a balloon inflates, and then that drone floats back to the surface. It takes pretty much all day for it to come back up because it's 4,400 meters deep. And then when it comes to the surface, it can put off a beacon, and then it can be found and pulled up, and we look at the sample. And what we're trying to find is what the seafloor looks like at that point, because it's never been mapped. It's never been seen by anybody by sea level. So this is all new. It's like a whole new planet, you know, and I say exactly the same thing you say. Why not just go and see? And then we'll know.
Well, I guess, why don't we? Well, it's expensive. It takes a lot of time. It's hard to get there. It involves Russian water space. That's wrong. There's air space. What is it? Russian sea. So, I mean, it sounds like there are enough problems to make it just damn near impossible.
Well, it's not impossible, but it is possible. But, you know, to charter the ship is $3 million. Then you got to get 120 scientists from their location to St. Petersburg, Russia, and home again. That's a layout of money. And then there's post-production work.
Then you've got to get the scientists. I mean, the scientists have got to be paid. I mean, they can't do it for free.
Well, no. Scientists are paid. What we do is we just give them lunch, and they're happy.
Okay.
Basically, you know, they're basically unpaid because their passage costs about $22,000. So we grant it to them. The idea is that we need... water chemistry experts. We need seafloor experts. We need experts on magnetometry to measure, to see if we can measure the electrojet coming out of this thin place in the crust. We need people that are experts in microbial sea life. We need equipment on board to be able to tell the crystallinity and salinity of the water. And this is going to be running 24 hours a day for 15 days. We'll create better than 3,000 hours of film in 15 days. And that's a lot of information. And not to mention the stress of having 120 scientists from all over the world on a boat in the roughest oceans on the planet. That could be one hell of a reality program.
All right. So there is the reality of the hollow earth. To even begin to start researching this is going to be a tough deal. And I know that there's a, I saw a video on YouTube before the show, and it talked about there was a flight from Berlin a couple of years back that they said they went over the North Pole. And I think 17,000 feet was the lowest they ever got. I mean,
that's it.
Who knows where they were? Who knows where they were? I mean, you know, it kind of, if it's all ice floes, it's all going to look all the same to me or anybody else. Who knows? You know, some air or whatever, obviously made a lot of money, charged those folks to go on this thing. So, I mean, this is a tough deal. It's like any time you're trying to explore something, you know, it doesn't matter if you're doing ghost hunting or if you're trying to be a professional wrestler and study, learn from the best, go through physical training and everything, doing anything right is tough to do. So when you look at now, I heard that you gained a good bit of negative publicity when you put out that you were going to do this trip and you were going to charge $20,000 if onlookers wanted to come on. Is that true? That you got some bad press? People were a little weirded out by the whole thing, right?
Well, when Steven was running it, that's what he was doing. He was selling seats on it. And then when I took it over, I said I think if we do that, we're going to have a boat full of rich tourists, and we're not going to accomplish the mission here. We have a limited amount of space. This is not a cruise liner. This is an old, you know, Soviet warship that's been converted into, you know, civilian use. Now the Arctic, of course, is a modern ship, but at the time we were using the Yamal or the 50 Years of Glory or the Captain Kolibnikov. These were the three boats that were available. Nuclear powered icebreakers. No, I think what happened was not the way we're running the expedition, because certainly the scientists with whom we were in communication, from Cambridge to Stanford to MIT to Harvard to Washington University, they're all legitimate, you know, organizations, and their grad students were very excited about going on this venture and being able to collect PhD level data, which they will never be able to get in their lifetimes any other way. No, all that was great. What hurt my career, I think, was the other half of this genre, trolls. There are people who think that any kind of exploration into anything that has to do with disclosure project or ghosts or any of that, that all that's paranormal and it should be excoriated. And there are people out there, and I'm not going to mention any names, but they make a hell of a good living destroying our lives. And I'm not the only one. There's a lot of my associates over the last 20 years that have all but been financially wiped out by these trolls. Now, I'm not, because I'm a professional engineer and I, you know, work for the Fortune 500, but I will tell you, it doesn't take long. Sooner or later, they'll Google me and they'll come up to me and say, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I do great work. And I have a great reputation, but they ask me the same thing that you ask me, you know, how can you believe that the earth is hollow? I say, look, you can go over every single bit of recorded information that I have provided, and it is a lot, and you know it is. I have never said that I believe the Earth is hollow. In fact, I don't say I believe much of anything. I'm a scientist. I look for data.
Okay.
No surprise there. No surprise there. That's so true with a lot of things.
Yeah.
Well, you got to admit that there are true explorers, which I think is one of the neatest things about humans.
Right.
We are true explorers. We like going to the unknown, to the depths of the ocean and to the distances of space. But there are people out there who are naysayers, and they want to make a living too, except they have no skills at all. And so the only way they know to get themselves higher is to step on someone else. And so that's what they do.
The constant antagonist.
Yes, we call them Democrats, but that's okay.
Well, in a sense, you're right. You've never, in our conversations, you've never said you believe in the hollow earth. You say you just want to find out what's going on, which I think is admirable.
That's right. That's right. What I say is we have a hypothesis that says that Earth is a molten ball floating through space, and we exist very peacefully on tectonic plates floating around on top of this magma like cornflakes in a bowl of milk. That's the hypothesis. Only problem is we can't find enough evidence to prove it.
Okay.
And then when we find other planets like Enceladus, or we find Pluto, or even Uranus, which that data we just got this year, by the way, they're hollow. In fact, Uranus has another planet on the inside of it.
I didn't know that.
Well, it's just new. It just came out this summer. We sent the probes up. It took a long time to get there. And we just got the data back, the thermal data back, and we've identified another planet on the inside of the gas giant Uranus. That's why its orbit is so anomalous compared to other planets in our solar system. We didn't know why. That's why we sent the probe. And we got the information back. Oh, it had a collision with another planet, and it's still on the inside of it.
So maybe the gas giant really is nothing but gas. It's probably, are they saying, because I don't know this, are they saying there's not a lot of substance of the gas giant, but inside all that gas is another planet? Is that the notion? I'm just asking for information.
There are two different types of matter that make up the planet Uranus. One is a very dense gas, which is certainly heavy and not, you know, all floaty. It's more like, Jupiter's also got a lot of gas around it, but it's liquid because it's under so much pressure. But it also has a solid on the inside of it, a lower vibrational matter on the inside of it. And, oh, I forgot to tell you one more piece of evidence, and that's from Cambridge University, which I think that was in 2012. And in 2015, the experiment was repeated by the Carnegie Science Group, and they were able to use what's called an anvil press, a diamond anvil press. And what they did is they took iron and they put it in a crucible and they smashed it between two industrial diamonds at the pressures that they expected to see on the inside of the center of the Earth. And then they shot a laser through the industrial diamonds into the crucible to heat it to 6,000 degrees C. And they did that because the frequency that we've been able to measure coming from the core of the Earth, this has been done in Japan and the U.S., is consistent with pure iron in crystalline form at 6,000 degrees C. And it, by the way, would put off a white light, which would be suitable for photosynthesis. not like our sun. That's a fusion reaction. I'm talking about electron excitation in the upper electron shells of the iron atom itself, but crushed to incredible pressures into a crystalline solid, a solid iron matrix, and then elevated to the temperature of 6,000 degrees C, which is, by the way, the temperature of the sun. So the density of that core and the purity of that frequency spike matches exactly what we're measuring coming out of the planet, or, you know, with our spectrometers. And once we redo the calculation, the distance from the sun to the Earth, which is our orbit, and the size of the Earth and the speed with which we go around the sun are all used in a calculation to estimate very closely, I might add, the weight of Earth. Well, if we do that calculation with the density of Earth being approximately, you know, 1 gram per cubic centimeter, which is kind of a fudge factor assumption that we used to make back in the 50s, it doesn't work. We're about 1,200 to 1,500 kilometers off in our orbit. But if we redo those calculations with a solid iron core and then a separate crust made of iron and nickel and aluminum, which is the makeup of our crust, the orbit fits perfectly. It means that we have a solid core, we have a void, and then we have a solid crust about 800 or 900 miles thick. That's the structure of Earth, and it fits the math. It fits the Lagrange calculations exactly.
A world within a world.
Okay.
Well, a solid iron, solid iron crystal rotating at the original speed of Earth. And then as the crust expanded and cooled, it slowed down. So the core is spinning faster than the crust, and that's why we have such a powerful magnetosphere around our planet.
Okay, and so that core you're talking about, that's the, quote, sun for the inside, correct?
Yes, yes. And it would, you know, like I said, not be a shortwave radiation like ultraviolet or X-ray radiation. This would just be iron light, like a normal plant grow life, a light. So it would be suitable for photosynthesis. You could grow plants underneath the sun like that.
Okay, well, I got a book. What's the name of the book? I've got it written down here, but there's a book entitled The Smoky God. You familiar with that?
Yes, I am. The Smoky God by I know the book very well. It's a story about a father and son that sailed. Yeah, they sailed in one side of the planet and came out on the other side of the planet. And there's another one called Edadorpha, which is Aphrodite spelled backwards. And it's a story about a man who allegedly walked into Mammoth Cave and ended up in the inner Earth. So I went to Mammoth Cave multiple times. I spent days and days going with the guides through those caves. And I finally asked one of the oldest guides there, and I said, how deep do these caves go, really? What's the deepest that anyone's ever recorded? He said 360 feet. So I think Edadorpha is probably just a story. Besides, if you were walking, even if you walked at a 45-degree angle, which I don't know if you've ever walked down a mountainside at a 45-degree angle, that's not easy to do. That's like a 10-12 pitch on a roof. Even if you walked at that angle, to go 900 miles would take you the better part of 2 months. No food, no water, and no light for 2 months one way. You would die.
That's apparent.
yeah. it just can't be done. I mean, you can go in a couple days, maybe 5 days, and maybe 5 days back out, but that's not going to get you there. To go 900 miles on flat ground is approximately from Nebraska to Salt Lake City. I can tell you, it's been done on foot. It takes about 40 days.
Mm-hmm.
You can go about 20 miles a day. And that's if you're, you know, Mormon and 6 foot five. Look at the people that walked up from Honduras. That's 2,000 miles. Some of them still aren't here. That's been a long time. It's, you know, you think about the practicality of these stories, and then you have to say, well, okay, that is personal testimony, uncorroborated. It goes in the uncorroborated file.
Right.
But I'm talking about hard measurements that have been made at great expense, millions and millions of dollars of grant money by highly qualified PhD physicists and geologists, and their papers are out there and you could read them, and I have read them, and they're very, very credible. They have good data collection, their methodologies are good, their scientific methods are good, and not only has it been peer reviewed, it's been repeated by other labs. It's real data. So that's why I want to take these scientists and I want to put them on a boat and watch them throw up for 15 days. People don't realize how rough these seas are. We're talking 10-story seas. The North Sea is the roughest sea in the world.
Right. Maybe that and the nature of the weather. I can't even imagine.
In the summertime, it can get up to about 34, 35 degrees, but there's nothing to stop the wind, and it blows all the time. So 34, 35 degrees with a 30 or 40 mile an hour wind, it's enough to cut right to the bone. Plus, the sun doesn't go down at all. You know, once you're above the 80th parallel, it's light 24 hours a day.
Wow. Like the roughest conditions imaginable. It's about.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
Oh, goodness.
But that's what would make it fun. That's what makes it fun, because, you know, you have all these shoulder cams, and then you're going to be interviewing these guys as they do their experiments, and you'll be inside the boat and outside on the deck. And then there's one other aspect to this, and this is the aspect that that makes everybody so passionate about this, I think. And I have to tell you, I have been around the world lecturing on this. I'll be lecturing in March in Sedona, Arizona on the 18th and 19th, and I will be in Las Vegas on the 19th and 20th lecturing on this.
Oh,
I've never, ever seen a subject that evokes this much passion in people, because people seem to have a connection with planet Earth that they cannot explain. It goes maybe back to their childhood, but I think it goes to the core of their being. And when I ask them about this more esoteric, more metaphysical aspect of this exploration, it's difficult for them to explain, but it's almost multidimensional. It's almost like there's a dimensional gate that we have to qualify for, or we're not going to be able to see anything up there. Right. And as a scientist, I can say, oh, well, you know, that's a bunch of malarkey. Or I can say, okay, I will meet the conditions of that qualification, and then we'll go and see. So we are going to be running meditation and chakra stimulations and color therapy. We're going to try and raise the consciousness of this ship to a point when we're 500 miles from another electric light, let alone a human being. We'll be the brightest consciousness signal in that portion of the world. In fact, I believe we may be the first ship ever to sail this particular area. If there is intelligent life, either on the seafloor or inside the Earth, or there's some dimensional gateway we have to go through, we may be visited by them. And if that happens, we will get it on film, because we're going to be filming invisible and infrared at all times.
Mm.
And if we get it, on film, it changes everything.
I believe it.
That's amazing. And we're going to be, we're going to be uploading our packets, crunching it as much as we can. We're going to upload the packets every 2 hours when the satellites come over. Because we won't have access, we can't radio anything, and there's no satellite communication, no cell phone communication up there. But we can bounce it off a satellite, and then the satellites can bounce it down to two receiving servers. One will be in the UK, I think it's going to be in Scotland, and the other is going to be in upstate New York. Once it hits those servers, it's going to be viewable online, and this is how we hope to monetize this whole trip. We're going to make that a subscription service, cheap, like $10 or something. You can watch the reality program of the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition 24 hours a day, and there'll be people that binge on it for sure, but it will give you access to what's going on live. So when we see it, you see it.
That's pretty awesome.
That you've got three volunteers right here to help the announcers and help put that out to everybody. That'd be a blast. You got some volunteers here for that part.
Well, that's good. That's good, because we're going to need them. You know how hard it is to make something go viral in this world. Unless you're friends with the Google boys, you don't get things out there viral. If you're friends with them, it's no problem. But if you're not friends with them, the masters of the universe will make sure no one sees it.
But your friends with Mark Zuckerberg, we can probably work that one out, maybe.
Yeah, Facebook. I don't think they're going to be around much longer. Facebook, their advertising. They used to do advertising, but since they started taking people's money and not doing the advertising, their stock dropped 25% in value in 1 year. That's not the kind of performance for a company that's going to be successful. Facebook will be going away in 2019. It'll be replaced by something else.
Probably Instagram. And as long as the Men in Black don't get us, they almost hijacked our show tonight. But perseverance to that,
great. You got to remember, the Men in Black are the ones that started Facebook. It originally was a DARPA project. It was funded and created by DARPA to collect personal information on everybody. And what happened was Congress said no. You can't invade people's privacy that way. So the day that they turned down the DARPA project, the next day, Facebook was founded. And it does exactly what the DARPA project was designed to do. And we do it voluntarily.
That's right. And the Chinese, God, they've got something even worse. They're monitoring absolutely everything that everyone in that country does. It's frightening what they're doing.
We're not so different. We're not so different. They have a social score. You start out with 1,000 points, and then, you know, they monitor what you buy and what you download and what you read and the videos you watch and your facial expressions and how you spend your money. We do the same thing. We have a slave score in our country. We call your credit score. If you're a good slave, then you have a good high score. you stay in debt, not too much, not too little. But if you're successful and you become debt-free and you actually live within your means, they'll destroy you. You can't move.
You know, it's funny. I just had something happen. I went to the bank to get a loan, and my banker said, if I didn't know you, you can't get a loan. I said, why? He said, because you don't owe anybody anything. I never thought
about
that.
That's right.
He said, you're not a good slave. He said, I'm just going to give you a loan because I know you'll pay it back. But, you know, he was shocked that I don't owe anything except my
That's
life
right.
to Devin and Papa Stro for being co-hosts on this show, which is wonderful, and all that. But I tell you what.
Well, did you know that if you don't have a good FICO score, if you don't have a good credit score, there are dating sites that you will not get a date. Because members of the opposite sex don't want to date someone with a bad credit score. So that slave score affects your life in a lot more ways than you think. We're not so much different than the Chinese. We rate, you know, what brand of green beans you buy and what videos you watch and what websites you surf. Yeah, we absolutely grade people on that.
That's true. Well, tell you what, Brooks, this has been fascinating. It's been a lot of fun talking to you and hearing you describe what's going on with this potential excursion up there to the top of the earth. And I think we all would like to see what's up there. And we'll stay in touch. We'll talk, and maybe we can help at least do some of the production over here to get folks listening and provide some of the entertainment hosting for it. I think it's a grand thing. So let me ask you this. After I want to have some more discussions offline over the next month or so, and I want to look at the additional resources that you have mentioned tonight on the show, and then can we have you back in about 6 weeks and talk some more? Would you be up for that?
I'd be delighted, absolutely. Anytime you want, I'll come back.
Well, good. And I hope Dustin, Devin, and Papa Stro will too. And as long as the men in black don't get me, I think we'll be okay. Yeah. I think they locked up my phone, frankly. That's okay. There's been a lot of fun. And so something that I learned from Papa Stro, what we do is we go around, you'll learn this, Brooks, we go around and we do plugs. We talk about what we're involved in, what's getting ready to come up in our lives or events that we're going to, and we've got a lot to plug. Devin, what have you got to plug over the next week until we get to our New Year's show for Scarecast? And by the way, be sure to tell us about the guest that you've got for us next week.
Sure. So, yeah, I have to go over. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I missed the question was directed to you. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, so on the 27th, our next week, we have Kristen Dwan. She's a psychic medium. She has died and been reborn herself after burning in a house fire. So she specializes in rebirth and reincarnation. So I think it's going to be great to talk to her right before the new year. And
wow.
I've been shooting a music video, so I have a new music video coming out next month, and that's about
awesome.
It. I'm about to go home for the holidays. So
now, will we be able
to
get a copy of it to promote?
Yeah, of course, for sure.
Great. Well,
that's
awesome. Wonderful.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And one other thing that I need to mention, I believe psychics are good luck for us. Because last week, Jenna Grover drove the number of downloads and listens to over 100 in the first 24 hours. So I called Jenna when I saw that, and it was wonderful. She was very, very popular. And so far, she's don't know about this week, but so far, she's been the number one show that we've had since we've got this new version of Scarecast. So we're very proud of Jenna. She's going to come back, and we're going to have just a crazy, crazy time. All right, so that's great, Devin. And all right, so now, Brooks, what have you got? And then we'll conclude with Papa Stro and then me. So, Brooks, what have you got going on that you'd like to plug coming up?
Well, as I said, I have two conferences coming up. One is called Beyond the Matrix. It's the 18th and 19th of March in Sedona, Arizona. And the other is the 19th and 20th of April, and it's in Las Vegas. You can register for either one of these. If you're close to those, it'd be great. I'd be happy to sign your books. I've got 10 books in print, and a lot of people out there are reading them and get them signed. Go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the events tab on the left-hand side, the events tab, and that will take you directly to those events. And you can see the 90-minute Hollow Earth presentation live. And it, believe me, it's pretty amazing.
All right. Well, that sounds good. And we'll get some links to all that up on ScaryCast so people can enjoy it. It's always good to have somebody else that's a personality that's in our same industry. So, yeah, we're glad to get those up so that I can take a look at them. So thanks a lot. Papa Stroh, what you got going on? You're going to be good. Busy man now.
So much going on. The Dust series, where I star as the Chief, and we just released our Season 3 trailer called Bloody Hell, which can be seen on the Dust series YouTube channel. Just type in Dust series in the search for YouTube, as well as their Facebook, which is facebook.com/Dust Series, the USK series. Also in stores and iTunes and Amazon is a film I'm in called The Rack Pack, or ACK Pack, with myself, Daryl Rackley, C. Thomas Howell, David Shifter, Tom Gore. A fun family film for everyone to enjoy. Be sure to check that out. Also, on the wrestling end, coming dates, January 12th, I will be in Somerville, South Carolina for Battleground Championship Wrestling. January 19th, I will be returning to Wilmington, North Carolina for UPWA Pro Wrestling. And my film documentary, The Maestro, done by Green Hero Films, will be screening and playing January 26th, my birthday, in Corpus Christi, Texas, at the South Texas Underground Film Festival. And for all the latest on TV, wrestling, and film, and merchandise, go to my official website at thestro.com, thestro.com.
All righty. And that's wonderful. And I guess what I've got going is we've got caricatures in Wilmington, an independent small, for 4 days, and then Christmas. I'll just finish the thought, and then back to time. Got a lot of exciting things going on. So it's been another very interesting episode today. And we got a lot of new events that I'm going to be posting on Christmas Day. I got to get Papa's Twitter scheduled. We won't hit all the events he can make it to. Devin, we want you to get out here. Maybe we'll get out there and have a grand time. And Brooks, I'll let you know if you got a couple opportunities. We'd love for you to speak to which we would like for you to speak. So I'll be getting up with everybody on that. So I wanted to say thanks to everybody. Brooks, you've been a great guest. I can't wait to have you back. We're going to learn more. We're going to talk more. And a good scientists are hard to find, I can tell you that. So it's wonderful to have you here. And we'll be having you back soon in January or February, whatever works for your schedule. Devin, have a great time in Kansas. Papa Stroh.
Thank you.
I'll be talking to you very, very soon. And hopefully I'll get to see you this weekend. If we can make it work out, we're going to have a Krampus event on December the 21st, which is Friday night. So I better get on all that. So look, thanks a lot, everybody. Have a great time. Have a great holiday season. And we'll be back next week with another great guest on the one and only ScaryCast. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Merry Christmas and happy holidays, everyone.
Good night.